Because the core will be reflecting the same.
Because it's just not expanding. So in Minkowski space, the size of the amplitude of fluctuations of wavelength lambda goes like 1 over lambda, which is to say that long wavelength fluctuations have small amplitude, and small wavelength fluctuations have large amplitude. This is the case without a mass. Remember that in the case with a mass, the long wavelength behavior isn't like the power minus 1/2, but minus 3/2. But other than that, this behavior. Okay, so fluctuations of large spatial extent, in particular, of large physical wavelength lambda, are suppressed. In everyday life, obviously, we don't see quantum fluctuations on length scales of everyday life. But the same equation, of course, indicates that at sufficiently small scales, there should be tremendously large fluctuations. Now, we considered a finite period of exponential expansion. We looked at the situation, we looked at the scenario in which we had, let's say, Minkowski space, exponential expansion, and then Minkowski space again. The expansion lasts from eta I to a final time eta f. The expansion is described by an exponentially increasing scale factor if the time variable is the proper time of a freely floating observer that moves along with a galaxy. When we use conformal time, then the scale factor behaves like this, minus 1 over h eta. It's, of course, the same exponential increase. It's just that in the new time variable, it looks has a different functional behavior. Remember that the conformal time has this funny behavior that the infinite past is described by eta going to minus infinity, and the infinite future is described by eta going to 0. So a small negative number is a late time, and 0 is the infinite future. So as eta goes to 0 from the left, from negative values, this becomes a very large positive number, which is just to say that the scale factor blows up towards the future. Now, we introduced the terminology that a co-moving mode K crosses, and that's what we call the crossing of the Hubble horizon, when in its mode equation, here it is, the sign of the frequency squared changes. So here's the mode equation of a fixed mode. Remember that a fixed mode has a fixed co-moving momentum, but this means it has a time-varying physical momentum, which is to say that it has a time-varying physical wavelength. Now, here's the time evolution of the amplitude of such a co-moving mode. And as we can see, during the period of exponential inflation, since A of eta grows larger and larger as eta approaches 0 from the left, we have that eventually, for every such mode, this thing can flip the sign so that 2 over eta squared is larger than k squared. This can happen for every mode, except for some modes, the exponential expansion period may end before that ever can change sign. See, if k is very large, then it takes longer for eta to dominate this, which is to say that for modes of short wavelengths, it takes longer until the sign changes. And indeed, we developed the intuition that the sign changes when the mode crosses the Hubble horizon, which is to say that when the mode's physical wavelength matches the proper length of the Hubble horizon. This is when the wave equation changes character. So remember that the co-moving mode is a mode whose wavelength over time increases. And if the mode starts out with a short wavelength, well, soon it will have a much larger wavelength. And at some point, it will match the horizon size. And when that happens, the sign flips. and we go from the usual oscillatory behavior to a behavior that is such that one of the solutions decays and the other one increases. This obviously happens when eta, when 2 over eta squared is k squared, which is to say that when eta is minus square root of 2 over k, and this time we call the horizon crossing time. So the horizon crossing time in conformal coordinates is minus 1 over k. We distinguish then small, medium size, and large size modes. Small modes are modes for which k is small wavelength modes, are modes for which the momentum is so high that this flipping of the sign never happens during the duration of the expansion. And medium size modes are modes for which this does happen during the inflationary period. And then large scale modes are such that the sign change was already in place when the inflationary period started. And of course, it didn't change back the sign. It just started out negative and stayed negative. Physically, those modes have such large wavelengths that even at the onset of inflation, they are larger than the Hubble horizon. In the case of very small modes, first case, we have that technically the horizon crossing time, what would be the horizon crossing time, namely minus 1 over k, is much larger than the end time of the inflationary period, so it never happens. This means that the Klein-Gordon equation, k squared, keeps dominating over minus 2 eta squared. The mode functions behave as in Minkowski space, which is to say that they behave like sine and cosine. They just, a basis of the mode functions in Minkowski space are sine and cosine, and the mode function for the Minkowski vacuum is, of course, just the cosine plus I times sine, which is the usual plane wave exponential function. The fluctuation spectrum for those small modes, we calculated explicitly, and we found that it stays like that. So it's just like in the case of Minkowski space, in the case of small modes. The amplitude of fluctuations of a particular physical wavelength lambda, remember that lambda always will stay for physical wavelengths, whereas capital L might stand for a co-moving wavelength or co-moving length. So the amplitude of quantum fluctuations of fields of wavelength, proper wavelengths lambda, decay like 1 over lambda with increasing physical wavelength lambda. Now that means, in particular, that when you look at one of those small modes that never crosses the horizon, what that means is that, actually, for each of those modes, the fluctuations decrease over time. Okay? It means that because the mode has a fixed k, but the fixed k means, over time, a larger and larger wavelength. Okay? Fixed co-moving momentum means fixed co-moving wavelength, but the fixed co-moving wavelength is, of course, over time, changing and an increasing physical wavelength. But the size of the fluctuations is a function of the physical wavelength. So as the universe expands and expands our modes with it, we have that the size of the fluctuations of the modes, the co-moving modes, goes down simply because their wavelength goes up. See, when the wavelength goes up, the size of the fluctuations goes down like this. So as long as a mode is increasing increasing its wavelength along with the universe's general expansion, nothing special is happening. It's going to decrease its fluctuations size as long as we don't have horizon crossing, right? These are the small modes, the modes that never cross the horizon. For those, the situation is that at very early times, these modes may have very small physical wavelengths and therefore very large amplitudes in their fluctuations, but they get tamed during the expansion and the fluctuations, such a mode's fluctuations decrease in size. Now, for the medium, for the case of medium-sized modes, we found that something else is happening. These are the modes which will experience a horizon crossing during the inflationary period. So in this case, in the Klein-Gordon equation, from the horizon crossing onwards, we have that minus 2 over eta squared dominates over k squared. And as soon as this term dominates over that term, the behavior of the Bessel functions is very different. And instead of having sine and cosine as the solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, now we have a decaying and a growing solution. And what we found is that in particular, the overall mode function then no longer depends on k. You see, we have a decaying solution, which just decays away, and we have a growing solution. But we also have that in order to get the fluctuations of the field, phi, not chi, this is all talking about chi, this was the Klein-Gordon equation for chi, we also have to divide by the scale factor. And those two time dependencies just canceled another out. Even the k dependencies canceled another out. And what we found is that the fluctuation spectrum, after the horizon crossing has occurred, after the Bessel function switched from sine and cosine behavior to the increasing, decreasing mode behavior, we find that the size of the fluctuations now behaves like that. And behave is not really the right word because it's constant. It's just the Hubble constant, the Hubble horizon parameter, times a number, 2^3/2, another number, the gamma function evaluated at 3/2, and then divided by pi. This is a fixed size of the amplitudes of the amplitude of the fluctuation. So what that means is that medium-sized modes experience something that the small-sized modes never experience. Medium-sized modes start out with very small wavelengths, much smaller than the horizon size. They may have very large fluctuations in quantum fluctuations in their amplitude. But then such a medium-sized mode, over time, will grow its physical wavelength. And initially, that will mean that its amplitudes of fluctuations will go down, like 1 over lambda. But then when the horizon crossing happens, then the size of the amplitude of the fluctuations no longer changes. It settles into this. No matter how long the inflationary period lasts, it's just this, a constant. It doesn't depend on k, it doesn't depend on time. So that means this. This opens up a tremendous opportunity here, namely that large fluctuations that are normally only occurring for very short physical wavelength modes can now happen also for very large physical wavelength modes. And that's because you can have a co-moving mode which starts out with a very small physical wavelength, therefore has very, very large quantum fluctuations. And then, depending on when it crosses the horizon, if the horizon crossing is very early, its wavelength, its physical wavelength is still short. Therefore, its fluctuations amplitude is still large, and then it keeps that fluctuation amplitude. Right? And so the smaller the Hubble horizon is, the larger will be the amplitudes of the fluctuations that we will see later on for the big modes. Because the smaller the Hubble horizon is, the smaller is the wavelength of the modes when they cross it, and therefore the larger are the fluctuations.
Yep. Small if the horizon period lies during the
bit. Not the wavelength, the amplitude of the fluctuations goes down if there's no horizon crossing. Then it's the amplitude of fluctuations goes down like 1 over the physical wavelength of the mode until the horizon crossing, and then the amplitude stays frozen, stays the same, even though the physical wavelength is increased. Yeah. Now, the amplitude of the fluctuations is this,
And the key parameter in this, well,
in fact, the only parameter in this is h, the Hubble constant. You remember what it did, the Hubble constant? We had that a of t was e to the power of h t. So the faster the universe expands, the larger h is, the larger will be the quantum fluctuations that we end up with. Totally directly. Okay?
Even for medium mode, if the fluctuation would be by 1 over lambda till the transition.
Till the transition, that's right. Until the mode functions change their behavior. From
it is important.
Yes, exactly. But we don't want to be bothered exactly with the transition. We look at the situation long before the transition. We have sine cosine behavior, we have behavior after the transition, long enough after the transition that really the behavior has changed away from sine cosine into increasing decay. Mm-hmm.
What time scale are these fluctuations?
Yeah, well, I'll get to that, right? I mean, how large do we have to choose h? In other words, how small do we have to choose the horizon length, the Hubble horizon length, during inflation, such that we get an appreciable size fluctuations here that could account for the inhomogeneities in the universe, right? That's the idea, of course, that those fluctuations would eventually account for the, would be responsible for seeding the initial inhomogeneities in the universe, okay? Yeah, the answer will be tremendously small, or h should be tremendously large. The Hubble length should be something like 5-6 orders of magnitude larger than the Planck length. So the expansion is tremendously large. And it doesn't even last a second. No, it doesn't even last a millionth of a second. It's like 10 to the minus 32 seconds. That's how long it lasts. And that is sufficient to blow the whole thing up. Yep.
That's how long it lasts. But the wide field is fluctuating up and down. What's sort of the time scale of an oscillation of the plot? Not that it oscillates, but you know, it has an amplitude, it jumps up to something big, goes down to something small.
Do you mean the actual fluctuations, or do you mean the mode function now?
The actual fluctuations.
You see, the actual fluctuations are potential fluctuations. It's all virtual, it's all quantum fluctuations until an interaction happens with another system. And that's at the end of inflation. All this is quantum stuff, is virtual reality, if you like, until you have the decoherence happening.
Okay. You see, the thing is that if a measurement of those quantum fluctuations took place earlier, it would completely change the system of the state. It wouldn't be the vacuum state anymore. And then the evolution from there on would be totally different. So you have to assume in this business that nobody's measuring any of that until inflation is over. And that is the natural time when it is being measured. Namely, the inflaton potential will decay, lots of particles will be produced, and those particles will be witness, so to speak, to what the field and gravity has done, and that will settle it. And we'll say, these fluctuations are the real ones. We have decoherence at that point. And that is when usual Big Bang cosmology sits in. Okay, so the conclusion so far is, assume that the expansion, the exponential expansion is very fast. H is very large. Then the Hubble horizon, 1 over H, or 2 over H, is very small. So as modes cross the Hubble horizon, which is to say when their proper wavelength is of the order of the Hubble horizon size, then their wavelength is still very small because the Hubble horizon is very small. And this means that modes still have very large fluctuations. Remember that they may start out with extremely short wavelengths, extremely large fluctuations, but the fluctuation size goes down as the physical wavelength goes up until they hit the horizon, from which point onwards the fluctuation size is frozen as long as the universe keeps expanding exponentially. So they keep these large fluctuations as their proper wavelength further increases. So therefore, if the time period during which inflation lasts is long enough, then modes with large fluctuations can even reach cosmological proper wavelengths. So on one end, here at eta initial, we may be talking about waves, co-moving modes, whose physical wavelength is smaller than the Hubble horizon, right? So it's going to be like Planck scale or smaller. And then at eta f, when the universe has expanded exponentially for a little while, then there's the very same co-moving mode that we talked about here at the beginning. That's the very same co-moving mode may have a physical wavelength of a gazillion light years. Okay? That's pretty dramatic.
No expansion before the De Sitter period.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Of course, we have to make things more realistic soon. This is still a little bit crude, and we will also have to discuss the question, why on earth would there be such a period?
Why would it start, and how would it end? It's no good just having this forever. We would, you know, have all sorts of phenomena, but everything would be ripped apart the moment it wants to form. Yeah, and the amazing thing about inflationary cosmology is that there is conceivably a good reason for why such a period would start and why it would end too.
So for all modes, there would be no protection or
backwards before the inflation period or after the inflation period. Like before the inflation after the inflation, the vacuum fluctuations would stay constant.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, before and after the inflationary period would be just the usual physics as we know. So now here's some preliminary estimate of this business. If this phenomenon that we are talking about is to describe the seeding mechanism for cosmic structure formation, and really the aim is that it is the only seeding mechanism, apparently we can use this framework to account so far, at least, for all of the inhomogeneities in the universe. We don't have to use 90% inflation and then some other mechanism too to account for some other observed stuff. So far as we know, inflation could be the sole reason for any inhomogeneities in the universe. So if that's the case, then H, the size of H, that is to say, the rate of expansion, the size of the horizon, therefore the size of the quantum fluctuations when the mode crosses the horizon. So the value of H determines then the amplitude of the later observed
quantum fluctuation. So if we observe in the cosmic microwave background tremendously large temperature fluctuations, that would indicate a larger H, roughly speaking. You will see it's actually not that simple. Once we get into how quantum fluctuations of gravity also might play a role. But roughly speaking, that's what it is. Roughly speaking, depending on how large the fluctuations are that we see in the cosmic microwave background, or how large the fluctuations are in the distribution of the galaxies in the universe, both are the same thing. It's just that the galaxies are a later picture of what the cosmic microwave background fluctuations show us happened earlier. Anyway, from observations, we should be able to determine what H is. And preliminarily, let me just tell you that H ought to be of the size of the inverse of 10 to the 5 Planck lengths, which is to say about 10 to the minus 29 meters. So the universe would have to have expanded exponentially at such a tremendous rate that the Hubble horizon was just 10 to the minus 29 meters. So any two people further apart than 10 to the minus 29 meters could not talk. Okay. All right. That's pretty quick, isn't it? So it means that, in the time that it takes light to cross 10 to the minus 29 meters, more space would have been created between those two points, 10 to the minus 29 meters apart, right? So that the light never really catches up, right? So remember that that was the particle picture interpretation of what the Hubble horizon means. Okay, now also the interval of exponential expansion or near exponential expansion must be long enough so that such small modes have time enough to expand to cosmological size. And what is nowadays usually assumed is that the time period really could be something like this. So basically the duration was about 10 to the minus 32 seconds. That's enough. It could have lasted much longer than that. It could have lasted 10 years. It doesn't matter, because only the end of inflation really matters to us. No.
No, not really. We only know
how long it must have lasted, at least. But it could have lasted much longer. You see, the earliest, I mean, it lasted 10 hours. The first 9 hours and, you know, 59 minutes and so on, 59 seconds, etc., would have just expanded modes that were tremendously small into tremendously large, much, much larger than what we see in the universe. We can only see 13.7 billion light years. And any wavelength significantly larger than that, to us, are just constant. So we don't have access to that. Okay, so now let's make this a little bit more realistic. Actually, really more realistic. This is basically how we do it now. The first question we have to ask, realistically, how can a period of near exponential expansion, because that's what we really need, near exponential, and dramatically fast, how can that ever be caused in a natural way? We don't want to just legislate that. It should be a natural thing to occur. Well, here's how you can do it. here's how you can see that this is plausible. We consider the action. The full action of physics as we know it looks like this. The action starts with the cosmological constant, then the Ricci scalar, then higher order terms in curvature, which we may neglect by Ockham's razor. Remember this monk Ockham who said that if there are several possible explanations, take the simplest one if there's no evidence to require something complicated. So this is complicated stuff. There's no physical evidence for any of that just yet. So we drop it for the moment, even though we know that quantum corrections, quantum fluctuations should induce terms of this kind, but very small ones. But to the first order approximations that suffice to do the cosmological studies, we don't need to worry about those terms. So we neglect the higher order terms in curvature. And then the action of physics continues with the other fields, electrons, quarks, gluons, the whole zoo of particles. And we postulate that there is a real scalar field as well. It hasn't been observed in nature. Scalar fields have been observed in accelerators. You can produce scalar particles. The thing, though, is that they are never elementary. We've not seen any elementary scalars, only composite ones. Pions, for example, can be scalars. Why not? But they are made out of two quarks. And quarks are not scalars. They're spinners. So let us, for the purpose of cosmology, we have to assume that there is a scalar field, a real scalar field. This is the action of it. And some suitable potential. What's the suitable potential? We'll soon see. Okay, so now further, we will assume that actually in the very early universe, this part and that part was dominating this part. And we can make sure of this by choosing the potential suitably, as you will soon see.
Like this could be some arbitrary scalar field which is not
there. Yeah, you just call it like that for the moment. We just call it like that and we will soon see why that would be. You see, the phi field is not only going to be a field that fluctuates and thereby causes the quantum fluctuations which see that the inhomogeneity is in the universe. No. The phi field will also be responsible for starting the inflationary period and for ending it. I think that's conceptually quite economical, because you could have a situation where you need one field to produce the quantum fluctuations, another field to cause the inflation to start, and then another field to cause inflation to end. But no, fortunately, one field does the whole trick there. An example choice for the potential would be this. You have m squared phi squared plus some lambda phi to the 4. In fact, it has, in
past few years that it has turned out that you don't even need the phi to the 4 term. Just an m squared phi squared term will do. But it's clearer to explain what's going on when you allow yourself the freedom to choose any arbitrary potential. And I will choose very soon to show you one which makes the mechanism perhaps a little bit clearer than if we had worked with just the quadratic or quadratic and phi to the 4 part. And also historically, the way I show it to you is how people came to think of it. So given this action, the full action of physics, what are the equations of motion? Huh? We vary s with respect to phi, and we get the Klein-Gordon equation. Oh, I should say that for the moment, let's look at the classical situation, classical equations of motion and their solutions. And then the quantum fluctuations will be an afterthought. For the moment, I mean, we know how the quantum fluctuations come about if we have this period. So at the moment, the question is not, the focus is not on the quantum fluctuations at all. For the moment, the question is, why would inflation ever start? And if it does, why would it end? Okay, and that's going to be an entirely classical consideration. Well, not quite entirely. The very beginning is quantum. But then the actual calculation through it is going to be classical. So this is all classical. The classical equation of motion for phi is the Klein-Gordon equation. Then we get the Einstein equation by varying with respect to the metric. And we have in the Einstein equation the energy-momentum tensor. Energy-momentum tensor is this. It's this expression in terms of the Klein-Gordon field, and I should say that in reality, of course, there are other fields as well, plus T mu other, for other fields. But we will assume that these first terms dominate the scene in the very early universe. Well, not only we will assume this, we will build things in such a way that this is so. Our model will have that as an obvious feature. So now let us wonder about homogeneity and isotropy. The Klein-Gordon equation and the Einstein equation are a set of coupled nonlinear partial differential equations, generally very hard to solve. Even classically, it is hard to solve them simultaneously. But as a lowest order approximation, we will now assume perfect homogeneity and isotropy. This is obviously technically an immense simplification, right? Because now we are only dealing with two differential equations for functions of one variable, namely the time, which means that they are ordinary differential equations, which means that they are way easier to solve, and at least numerically constitute no problem at all.
Equation is a generalization of the relativistic.
Yes, but it's number value. We're looking for number value solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. So the phi field is just assumed to be classical field. So obviously, homogeneity and isotropy are very nice to assume mathematically. But you have to ask, why on earth is that a reasonable assumption? Why would the universe start out this way? Why would it not choose to be dependent only on the x2 variable? Then it would be constant in x1, x3, and t. And what makes us believe that this is a good assumption here? Oh, I wanted to say that also technically this means that we are, it's mathematically equivalent to saying we're looking only at the k equals 0 modes. If you look at the field, the k equals 0 mode is the constant part of the field. Okay? So if you do the Fourier decomposition, the lowest Fourier mode is the 0 mode. So you can also view this as considering the 0 mode. Anyway, why would that be a good assumption? Well, essentially, as we will now address, or soon see, the idea is that the universe may not have started out this way. But if, by whatever means, we can get this thing going, then we will soon have
for our practical purposes, flatness and homogeneity. Because if you take something crumpled and now you blow it up by 100 orders of magnitude, then it will probably look pretty smooth once you've blown it up this much. I have to say, though, that a careful study of general relativity has shown over the past 20 years, it's not all that known, actually, among cosmologists, because it was mathematicians who found that. Thing is that actually, when you blow up a space-time like that exponentially, and it started out with wrinkles, then you're not really ironing out the wrinkles. You're only making them bigger. But that should be enough. It should be enough for our purposes, because if we look at the fixed size volume, then wrinkles that have been blown up to very long wavelengths would look basically constant. Anyway, but we still have to answer, why would inflation start? And therefore start blowing up things and flattening in that sense. Well, for that we'll have to look into the equations of motion. The equations of motion simplify now dramatically if we have homogeneity and isotropy. Here we have the Klein-Gordon equation, and here we have what happens to the Einstein equation. Remember, the Einstein equation has on the left-hand side the Einstein tensor, which is to say the Ricci scalar and the Ricci curvature tensor, and it has a cosmological constant. On the right-hand side, it has the energy momentum tensor. Now, when, in principle, this is a matrix equation with 4x4 matrices. Energy momentum tensor, for example, is a 4x4 matrix. But when you assume homogeneity and isotropy, things simplify tremendously. Instead of having 16 coupled differential equations, you now have only two. The Einstein equations reduce to only an equation for the 0-0 component and an equation for the II components. And each II component of the Einstein equation has simply this same form. Similarly, also the expression for the energy momentum tensor of the inflaton field simplifies. Here we go. The energy momentum tensor for the inflaton field now takes this simple form. The 0-0 component is this. The II components are that. There's no summation over I. So each diagonal element of the energy momentum tensor has this entry. And yes, it is. It's exactly the energy momentum tensor that we had above. Here we go. It's this energy momentum tensor where we dropped the energy momentum that comes from the other fields, assuming that the Klein-Gordon field will dominate everything. And what we've done here is that we have assumed homogeneity and isotropy, which means that we threw away lots of those derivatives. Okay, whenever there was a spatial derivative, throw it away. Because if it's homogeneous, there's no spatial derivative. Okay, so the simplified version then, the isotropic homogeneous version of the energy momentum tensor of the Klein-Gordon field is this. It has only two non-trivial components, and they are these. Now, the 0-0 component of the energy momentum tensor is given a name. We call it rho of t. And the II component of the energy momentum tensor of our Klein-Gordon field is called p of t. And people go further, and they call this the pressure of the Klein-Gordon field, and that the energy density of it. Now, the energy density, that's okay to call that the energy density, because remember that this thing really is the Hamiltonian. I mean, if you integrate that over space, you get the Hamiltonian. But that, I mean, think about it. A Klein-Gordon field has no pressure. A fluid has a pressure. A gas has a pressure. But why would the Klein-Gordon field have? I mean, the thing is that if you considered a fluid, an actual fluid, if you consider that in space-time and look at its energy momentum tensor, you would find that the II component is the pressure of it. So therefore, the terminology was used, is being used also for scalar fields, even though technically they are not fluids or gases. So this is the pressure then, where you just have to keep in mind it's not a fluid or gas, it's a quantum field, or in this case, a classical field even. All right, so the terminology is the 0-0 component's energy density, perfectly justified because the If you integrate that over space, you get the energy. You get the Hamiltonian of the phi field. You get the H superscript phi. Okay? I mean, this was T naught naught integral D3x. Now, another terminology that's very important, I'm putting out all this. I mean, I could do without this terminology, but when you read papers on cosmology, you will see people referring to those things without defining them, because they're so common that everybody in that field knows them, so you better know them too. The ratio of pressure and energy density, pressure above, energy density below, that thing, W of T, in principle, that's a function of time, of course, right? That thing is called the equation of state parameter. Again, it really makes no sense in the context of fields. This is derived from thermodynamics. Or this is the terminology taken or borrowed from thermodynamics, where when you have a fluid, you have an equation of state that relates the energy density to the pressure. And following that fluid analogy, the relationship between pressure and energy density, which for fluid is called the equation of state for a fluid, is pressure is equal to some constant times energy density. And that constant is the parameter in the equation of state. So this is also in cosmology now called the equation of state parameter. Very important parameter, because if you only know the value of this, you can already tell a lot about how the universe is behaving, as we will see soon now. How about the problem of actually solving those equations? See, what are the equations that we have to solve now? Well, we have to solve the Klein-Gordon equation. We have to solve the two Einstein equations. And for that purpose, we have to express the energy-momentum tensor here in terms of the field, right? Which we did. We have that here, right? So here's the energy-momentum tensor expressed in terms of the field phi. So really, all we have here is a set of coupled differential equations for phi and the scale factor. Now, can we not just solve this once and forever, and then we're done with it, if need be numerically? Well, we can't, because there's one unknown in this, or one thing that still needs to be specified. That's the potential. Okay? So if you specify a potential, then you've specified the equations that you have to solve. Once you've specified what the potential is, what V is as a function of phi, for example, V could be phi squared, could be phi to the fourth, up to a constant or whatnot. Once you've specified V of phi, you have the Klein-Gordon equation, the Einstein equations, that's all you have to solve. Then, as far as classical physics is concerned, you can calculate how the field phi behaves over time and how the universe's size or the scale factor behaves as a function of time. And as I said, it's only ordinary differential equations. Everything depends only on one variable, the time. So it's doable, at least numerically, not a problem at all. And in fact, you know, why don't you try that? Just as a little exercise, cook up a potential, plug it into MAPLE, and run it through and see what your universe is doing. And the field is doing what the universe is doing. Of course, in practice, we do it the other way around. We measure what the universe is doing and the field, and then we try to work backwards what the potential might have been. And there's a whole industry studying just that. Because that's a big unknown. That's the big unknown about the inflationary field. What potential did it obey? Okay, so in principle, all of this is solvable once you're given the potential. At least numerically, you can solve for A and for phi. All right, but let's get serious now. We still haven't answered the big question. Why would an exponential, a period of near exponential blow up ever happen? Why would it ever start? Well, let us start with a Let's begin with a basic observation. The cosmological constant lambda normally sits on the left-hand side of the Einstein equation. This is where Einstein put it. Cosmological constant on the left-hand side. But of course, we can throw it on the right-hand side. Just put it over there with a minus sign. Or actually, it was on the minus. It was with a minus sign on the left-hand side, so it gets a plus sign on the right-hand side. When we do that, it can be viewed as a contribution to the energy-momentum tensor. Now remember that the cosmological constant did not. Let me just show you the Einstein equation. I don't have to do all of this in the air. Up, oh, where is it? Well, let me show you the original. Here we go. Here's the Einstein equation. Okay, so here we have lambda. It multiplies the metric, and the metric has plus and minus signs. Now we can put this thing from the left-hand side to the right-hand side, and then view lambda as the contribution to the energy-momentum tensor. Okay, and here's a minus sign, which means that lambda will effectively contribute positively to the energy-momentum tensor, because this term arrives with the minus sign over here. So we have minus 8 pi g, bracket opened, t mu nu, plus lambda g mu nu, bracket closed. But the g mu nu has alternating sign, right? So let's see what happens when we write this thing out in the homogeneous isotropic version, where this reduces to only two equations, one for t naught naught, one for tii. What does it look like? Here we go. This is the equation for t naught naught. This is the equation for the II components of the Einstein equation. And we see the cosmological constant is on the left-hand side of the equation, where Einstein put it initially. But when we throw it on the right-hand side, then what do we see? Then we see that we have here a plus one-third lambda. And we have the positive sign here. Okay? So that means lambda contributes positively to the energy density. I mean, a positive lambda contributes positively to the energy density. But a positive lambda will contribute, as you will see in a moment, negatively to the pressure. I mean, we see it already. This is the pressure, remember. This is the pressure, but it comes with a minus sign. So if you put this over there, it takes away from the pressure. It is negative pressure. So the cosmological constant's effect in the Einstein equation, when we view it as part of the right-hand side, is that it increases the energy density and decreases the pressure. It acts as a positive energy and negative pressure. Of course, thermodynamically, the notion of pressure really comes to a limit here, right? You can't push it too far. The cosmological constant simply is not a fluid or gas. Anyway. So, that's our first observation here. I think I just gave it all away. This was meant to be an exercise. Okay, so to show that positive lambda plays the role of a positive energy density and a negative pressure. Okay, which means that if the universe had simply no matter fields in it, no Klein-Gordon field, no other fields, only the cosmological constant, then we would have a positive energy and a negative pressure of equal size. And that would mean that the so-called equation of state parameter would be minus 1. Because remember, it's the pressure over the energy density. Okay? Now, the pressure would be negative, and the energy density would be positive of the same value. So it's a minus 1. On the other hand, if the only universe, as is realistic in real life out there, has some energy momentum tensor that's non-zero, then if you throw the energy, then if you put the cosmological constant to the right, then the larger the cosmological constant is, the more it will drive W towards minus 1. If the cosmological constant is very large, much larger than the other energy momentum tensor, then it will drive this towards minus 1. For ordinary matter, this is always larger than minus 1, because the pressure is always smaller than the energy density. Okay, so why are we looking at this? Well, it turns out that if the cosmological constant were, just hypothetically, If it were dominant, then we would have this. If the cosmological constant for some reason were much larger than all the other contributions to the energy momentum tensor, then that would result an exponential expansion basically with this here as lambda. And that will give us a hint as to how realistically this sort of thing can happen. Not to a cosmological constant, but something very similar. So let's look at it. Let's look at the zero-zero component of the Einstein equation. It is this. You may not remember, but I just copied it from above. This is the zero-zero component of the Einstein equation. Now, if the cosmological constant dominates over T naught naught, so we can forget about this, then all we have is A dot over A squared is one-third of lambda. One-third times lambda. And directly, without any further ado, we see that this means exponential expansion. Because if the derivative of a function is proportional to the function, that's what this says, okay, then, yes, then the solution is exponential expansion. Okay, so clearly, if A dot over A is a constant, then we must have exponential expansion, or in fact, exponential contraction. So we have a solution, and which means that the universe, as soon as the cosmological constant dominates, the behavior of the universe will be an exponential behavior with the exponent, the Hubble constant, being square root of the cosmological constant over 3. This is important because it gives us a hint, as we will soon see, as to why and how the universe would ever undergo such a period in the very early universe. But also, let me just remark that nowadays, if you look at the universe as it is today, it seems that, in fact, lambda is bigger than that. It seems that if you look at the total energy content of the universe, this makes up 30%, and lambda makes up 70%. It's just what observations tell us over the past 5 years or so. It turns out that, or 10 years, but since 5 years, we're pretty sure about this. So it appears that this is the case. We're not quite in a clean situation yet, where lambda is so big that we can forget about this. But if it's really true that lambda is 70% of the right-hand side of the Einstein equation, and matter energy momentum is only 30%, then we are actually in an accelerating phase, accelerated expansion phase of the universe, which means that matter is going to be more and more diluted, which means that this becomes smaller because that's the density, energy density. But of course, cosmological constant is a constant. It's not getting diluted. So this thing will win eventually, and we end up with an exponential expansion. So apparently, that's in our future, exponential expansion. Anyway, so what lesson does this teach us? We don't believe that a cosmological constant would have been responsible for a short period of exponential expansion in the very early universe, lasting from 10 to the minus 34 seconds to 10 to the minus 32 seconds. And why don't we believe that? Well, it's because the cosmological constant, for that purpose, would have to have been tremendously large, okay, because H has to be tremendously large, so that the horizon length is only 10 to the minus 29 meters. H would have to be enormously large. And if H were a lambda cosmological constant, the cosmological constant would have been very large, but it's a constant. It's a constant. It would still be that large, and we would still be accelerated. I mean, you know, just inconceivable. We know that the Hubble horizon is now not 10 to the minus 29 meters, but if it was caused by a constant, it would still be. So obviously, it cannot have been a constant because this would have meant that inflation would have gone on forever in the past and forever in the future. So it cannot have been caused such a temporary period in the very early universe by a cosmological constant. But we now see that whatever caused it should have looked temporarily like a cosmological constant, or could have looked temporarily like a cosmological constant. And it turns out that there's a very realistic possibility for this. Instead of a fixed number lambda, a fixed constant, which is large enough to account for this tremendously large age during the very early universe, instead of a constant, consider this possibility. The universe might originally, very long back, more than 13.7 billion years ago, the universe may have been in a generic state. And by that I mean, it might have been some run-of-the-mill, crumpled universe. It might have been full of curvature, and some parts of it might have expanded, some other parts of it might have contracted. Think of a generic universe. It doesn't really matter what it did. That's the kind of thing we would like as initial conditions, because obviously if this leads to our universe, that's pretty good, right? You want to not to have, you don't want to have to assume lots of fine-tuning in the initial conditions. So let's assume this. The universe is in some totally generic state. So we have some spatially varying curvature, we have some expansion or contraction, and that may possibly even be dependent on where, so some places may be expanding, some other may be contracting, and there may have been matter and radiation going all around. It could have been just a mess. Now, let's further assume that one of the physical fields was a real scalar field, obeying the Klein-Gordon equation with some potential V of phi, and of course, a lot of the magic is going to be in the V of phi. Let us assume that the potential V of phi has a particular form. And I will show you in the next slide what that form... I mean, it doesn't have to have just one particular form, but it has to be a potential which has a particular property. Okay, so all we assumed so far is the universe is in some generic state, and we assumed that we have a Klein-Gordon field with some potential term, which could be as simple as a phi squared. Then, at some time, it could have happened that phi fluctuates. Phi would always fluctuate, of course, but it could happen at some time phi fluctuates to the extent that some patch of that pre-universe, some patch of it, some patch of significant size, and that size doesn't have to be big, the potential was temporarily elevated, very high. Temporarily dominant over all the other terms in the energy momentum tensor. Okay, you see the idea here? The quantum field phi fluctuates all the time. And it may just happen that in a whole patch, it has an elevated, it has a value, it happens to have a value of phi such that V of phi is a very large value. Okay, it could just happen. It could just happen that the phi field fluctuates in such a way that at some point in time, it just happens to have a value of phi in a patch whose corresponding V of phi is very large. So large, in fact, that in this patch, it dominates over the T00 and the TII. I mean, no, so far, just the V of phi dominates over the T00, over all the energy density that's there because of matter, because of other matter, because of other fields. Now, what would that mean? Well, that would mean that at this place, the universe, that pre-universe, spawns another one, spawns another universe. And the way this would work is this. And we don't really have to assume that this patch is very large. It could be just a few Planck volumes large, really. You know, a few Planck lengths this way, a few Planck lengths that way. It doesn't have to be very large. Of course, we are allowing this to be a very rare fluctuation because we have all the time in the world. It could be a very big universe, and we could be waiting for a very long time. But as long as it's possible, it might happen. Okay. So now this patch where the field takes values, just as a fluke, takes values such that V of phi is very large. this patch would in effect have something like a temporary cosmological constant. It won't have a cosmological constant, but it will have terms occurring in the equations which look as if they were temporarily a cosmological constant. So here's an example of a potential, and many other potentials could be written down. But this is the classic one that people started out with when they studied inflation. It's the, you know, the textbook example. So this is V of phi. It's an assumption for how V of phi could look like, the thing in the action for the Klein-Gödel equation.
The patch B of significant size.
Oh, right. Good point. Remember that when we took the cosmological constant and put it on the right-hand side and then compared to the energy density and the pressure, right? The thing is, we did that under the assumption of homogeneity and isotropy. If we had not assumed that, then there would have been terms that have space derivatives. And no space derivatives can actually interfere with our argumentation there. They could contribute positively and negatively and so on. So as long as this fluctuation is spatially homogeneous, those spatial derivatives don't get in the way, and this logic still applies. It's not a necessary condition that there's spatial homogeneity, but it's certainly sufficient. Yeah, very good question. I think I should update the lecture notes for that. Okay. All right. So assume that this is the potential for the Klein-Gödel field. Why not? You can write down a polynomial that looks like this, for example. Now, what does that mean? If you have a Klein-Gödel field which has this kind of potential, then if you don't feed the Klein-Gödel field any energy, then the value of the Klein-Gödel field is going to be this, because that's the lowest energy. Okay? That's the lowest energy value. If you supply energy to the Klein-Gödel field, then it can have other values than phi c, for example, here or there. Now, this height here, that's the energy scale here, V of phi, this height here is assumed to be very large. It's of the order of the Planck energy, Planck energy density. So let's assume we have a potential that looks like this. Then in principle, it could happen that the field phi fluctuates around this value where it usually would be found. This is, by the way, called a vacuum expectation value. It's a field that, even in its ground state, has a non-zero expectation value for its amplitude. You can very easily get that if the field is exposed to a potential like this, because then the lower energy state is a state in which the field has a non-trivial amplitude. It's not important that this is not zero. You could just take this picture and, you know, move the graph inside. I mean, you could have the zero here, and then the potential goes up like that. I'm just showing you the picture like this because it's in the textbooks like this. It doesn't matter what the value of phi really is. You could have that the minimum sits here, and then the potential goes up like that. Okay, so if you supply energy to the field, then it could have other values, phi. Okay, and if you supply a lot of energy to it, it could even have the value zero, for example, in which case V of phi would be tremendous, which is why you have to supply energy to it. Now, of course, the field can fluctuate, and the field will fluctuate. And therefore, occasionally, it might just fluctuate so that it has that value, in this case, the way we drew the potential, the value zero, so that it's sitting at the very top of the potential. Doesn't have to be the top of it. I mean, just anywhere up here in this quasi-plateau. It would happen sometimes. Okay? Now, what does that happen? What does that mean? Well, it means that even though it is energetically expensive and then therefore a rare quantum fluctuation, sometimes the field phi may find itself up here in a patch, of sufficient size. Well, we can go into the Einstein equation and Klein-Gödel equation, and solve them simultaneously.
and see what happens. And what we will see is that when you have a relatively constant or near constant value of V of phi, the V of phi contributes to the energy density, and that will, in the equations of motion, the Einstein equation and the Klein-Gödel equation, in effect, produce what the cosmological constant would have done, and therefore produce a quasi-exponential expansion of the space-time. The scale factor will scale nearly exponentially. At the same time, the Klein-Gödel equation now will also have a non-trivial evolution. And you can ask, well, what evolution will it have? Well, the Klein-Gödel equation will have an evolution that is basically, well, you have a potential here, and you have a particle that's exposed to this potential. I mean, you have a degree of freedom that's exposed to this potential. If it starts out here, it will move down there. Okay? So, well, before I make that concrete, let me just give you the full picture then. So the idea is, this picture is supposed to provide the answer to why would inflation ever start, and when would it end? So why would it ever start? Well, you have this Klein-Gödel field, and it fluctuates around, and sometimes in a patch, it would find itself at a value of the field phi such that the potential is very large. In fact, so large that it by far dominates all the other contributions to the energy, and in fact, such that the V of phi is temporarily just like the H, or just like the square root of lambda, this energy density. And then you have exponential expansion of the space-time. All the while, the Klein-Gödel field is a field exposed to this potential here. So your modes have the property that they will try to go down this potential, you know, like any classical mechanics system, will go down this potential slowly, which means that this H will very slowly decrease, because the H is the energy density, in effect, will very slowly decrease. And then eventually you have that the potential drops off, and the Klein-Gödel field settles into its true vacuum state, into its, no, not vacuum, but true ground state, where it has the lowest energy. And where will all that energy go? Well, the energy that is stored in here will go into the production of all sorts of particles. The inflaton field will interact with all the other degrees of freedom, because now it has energy to give away, and will do so. It's an assumption that the Klein-Gödel field might have a potential which is nearly flat and then drops off. That's the overall assumption. If you have a potential that can be traveled slowly to provide for a period of exponential expansion, you need a period where you have a slowly changing potential at a very high energy level, so that you have, in that period, quasi a cosmological constant temporarily, exponential expansion, and then the potential drops down, the universe stops exponentially expanding, and all that energy is turned into particles.
Fluctuation has to be measured somehow.
It'll be measured when this energy is transferred into the production of all these other particles, because those other particles will in effect measure what the field has been doing and what the gravitational degrees are doing. They are witness to that, and therefore decoherent.
So the fact that phi goes towards phi c is an assumption.
No, it comes out from the Klein-Gödel equation. See, it's on the next slide.
What happens to the right side?
Well, actually, if you follow the evolution here, what do we have? The Klein-Gödel equation looks like a harmonic oscillator with a friction term plus the potential. Okay. So what we have is that the particle will slowly go down this thing, and then it will oscillate a little bit to the left and to the right. And in fact, this oscillation period to the left and to the right, when it does that before it settles here, this is the time that it excites all the other degrees of freedom. Or the other field degrees of freedom, like it's electrons, quarks, and so on.
Like you said, if we wait long enough, we could put that that phi in any given value, right? So mm-hmm. To the right side, it might be.
Oh yeah, sure. It could also be on the right hand side, like this inflation could also work if it initially started out
fluctuating to this place. Yeah,
that's right.
Yes, but we have to speed up a little bit. We started late, but
okay.
But it's exciting stuff. So, okay, concretely now, the Kaifun equation looks like this. You know, you have the friction term here, and you have the potential term. The potential term now is defined to include the m squared pi squared term as well, right? Ordinarily, you would write down perhaps the m squared pi squared term separately, but it's now containing the v. Okay, so the Kaifun equation, therefore, looks just like the equation of motion for a ball that rolls down a hill. It's just exactly the same type of equation. Of course, it is not a ball that rolls down a hill, but the amplitude of the phi k is just like that. Okay, so this means that dv by d phi is acting like a force. The field will want to go down to its smallest place of the potential, as always. If you differentiate a potential with respect to the degree of freedom, you get a force. So it's been put this way. On the other hand, that's a friction term here. This will slow it down. So overall, we will have what is called a slow roll inflation. It is as if a ball were rolling slowly down. And that is the period of inflation, the period during which v of phi is very large and therefore acts as if they were a cosmological constant. Okay, so definition is that if the initial value of v of phi is very large and the initial slope is very flat, this is all what these are properties of this potential, then this is to say that this ball is slowly rolling during the period. And we therefore have an approximately constant V of phi. But to be more precise, actually, the V of phi is, of course, decreasing slowly over time. So during the inflationary phase, you would expect that the H is decreasing, which is to say that the Hubble horizon should slowly increase over time, which also means that the quantum fluctuations that we observe at large scales should actually be decreasing over time, right? Because the smaller the Hubble horizon is when the mode crosses the horizon, the larger are going to be the fluctuations that it preserves while it's expanded, right? Now, if the Hubble horizon is increasing in size, then over time, during inflation, it means that the modes which were later, that later cross the horizon, will eventually end up with smaller quantum fluctuations. Okay? So over time, the quantum fluctuations are a little bit smaller. And very recently, just like, like 3-4 years ago, experimental evidence was found for that actually the quantum fluctuations of the later modes are a little bit suppressed compared to those of the earlier modes. Okay, so the terminology is slow roll inflation. Now, here's an observation. During the slow roll period, we have that V of phi dominates over 1/2 phi dot squared. Remember, homogeneity, we ask for in this original patch, so that we don't have to worry about the space derivatives, because the space derivatives come with the opposite sign, so that they could screw things up. Okay. So now, this is W of t. This is the pressure over the energy density. So you see that if you go through the calculations there, that not really calculations, just put it into the definitions, you will see that the V of phi contributes not only positively to the energy density, it also contributes negatively to the pressure. So really, V of phi enters here just in the same way that a cosmological constant would, namely adding to the energy density but taking away from the pressure. And therefore, the equation of state parameter W approaches -1, is close to -1, during the inflationary period when the potential is very large. So temporarily, we have a equation of state parameter that goes to -1. If you go to a random talk on inflationary cosmology here at PI, you will, at some point sooner or later, hear somebody ask, what if W is smaller than -1? And that's because some people said it's not experimentally excluded that W might be smaller than 1. But what you see here is that theoretically it's excluded. It just can't happen. Even if, no matter how big you make V, the smallest you can get, this is -1. Okay, that's why it is so exciting on the one hand, that experiments seem to be consistent with a
period of where W was 1 and minus 1. But on the other hand, theoretically, we wouldn't know how to handle it if experiments were really strongly indicating that. They are not. I mean, it's just that the error bars stretch into the territory where the error bars for W stretch into the territory where W could be smaller than minus 1. Okay. So let's see. We saw that the V of lambda will act like a temporary cosmological constant, but will we also get temporary exponential inflation? Well, here we have the Einstein equation. And now let us say that the energy density is completely dominated by the energy density of the Klein-Gordon field, and the cosmological constant we assume now to be negligible. In fact, the cosmological constant we measure today is really tiny. It wouldn't matter at all in this consideration of the early universe, because in the early universe, larger energies were involved than the little bit of energy density that we see nowadays. You see, the particle density is not very high in the universe. It's high here in this room, but it's not high out there in this open space. It's like, do we have a handful of particles per cubic kilometer? It's not much. But the energy density in the early universe was on the order of the Planck energy density, which is, of course, enormous. Okay, so now, during the slow roll period, we have that V of phi dominates the scene. This is, therefore, the Einstein equation. And what this tells us right away, without looking at anything else, is A dot over A is quasi-constant. Therefore, we have quasi-exponential expansion, except that it's not quite exponential because we know that V of phi is slowly decaying during this near plateau phase, and therefore A dot over A has a slowly varying constant there. So it's not really H as a constant, but H, which is time dependent. And of course, eventually the V of phi drops off, and the exponential expansion comes to a halt. Well, it's no longer exponential. It will still continue to expand the universe, but no longer exponentially. So therefore, we have that during the period of inflation, this is what the scale factor is doing. Remember that if it were a cosmological constant, it would be simply lambda over 3. And now that it is the inflaton energy density, it is 8 pi g v of phi over 3. Okay, so this tells us right away what the Hubble horizon is during such a phase. So during the inflationary period, we would have a slowly varying Hubble parameter. Then A dot over A is a slowly varying function. And since it's no longer a constant, we can't call it Hubble constant, so we call it the Hubble parameter function. In the case where we would have exactly exponential expansion, obviously the Hubble parameter would be Hubble constant. In the case of slow roll inflation, we have this expression for the time-dependent Hubble parameter. Right? It's just from this. Okay. Displace the role of H. Therefore, H is this. Where V is a function of phi, and phi is a function of time. Now, this is something that I already mentioned, namely that since the Hubble parameter is changing over time, slowly, but definitely changing over time, if it didn't, inflation would never end, right? Because the ball would sit up there and never go down to its true vacuum, to its true ground state. So it has to have a slope. And the fact that there is a slope, the fact that the Hubble constant is changing over time, the fact, therefore, that the Hubble horizon is changing over time, means that the modes cross the horizon at different horizon sizes, and therefore the modes will have larger quantum fluctuations preserved when they start early crossing the horizon, and those that cross the horizon late will have smaller quantum fluctuations preserved. And as I said, the WMAP satellites, CNB data, indicate that the data are consistent with this theoretical expectation. So how about the end of inflation? I mentioned this already. At the end of inflation, the ball rolls down. Energy becomes available for the production of all sorts of other particles. This is what is called reheating, the reheating phase of the universe. It's a misnomer. because that would assume that the universe was hot before. But we don't care what it was before. It could have been cold, could have been hot. All we needed is that there was a patch in which the potential happened to be elevated for a while. And so reheating is really not the right word, but it definitely was heated because those particles were not only produced sitting there at rest, but there was so much energy available that those particles were produced with a lot of energy, so very hot. So from here onwards, you have a period of a hot Big Bang cosmology. You know, the pre-inflation, before inflation was accepted as the standard model for cosmology, the idea was that there was just a Big Bang, hot Big Bang, and then standard physics came after that, nuclear synthesis and so on. And this is where the hot Big Bang starts. But of course, with an explanation now for why the universe would look so flat and why it is inhomogeneous to a certain extent with a certain distribution of fluctuations. So now, regarding quantum fluctuations. Because so far, this was all classical, except for the very beginning. We said that the quantum field may start out in such an elevated potential state in a patch because of a quantum fluctuation. But then we said it's also big, and we neglect the quantum fluctuation. Now let's look at the quantum fluctuation. So let us assume some potential V of phi, for example, the one that I drew, and suitable initial conditions, which give us solutions phi of 0 and a of 0. So suitable initial conditions means that there was such a suitable quantum fluctuation, such that we had a period of inflation for a suitable time interval. Now, and that's the key step here, we will allow for small inhomogeneities in the inflaton field. So far, we looked only at the zero mode. We only looked at the constant part of the inflaton field, because that had tremendously large amplitudes and a big evolution and all of that. Now let us look at the possibility that the inflaton field might fluctuate. And of course it will fluctuate. You see, classically, you could just say, well, okay, we have so much expansion that we end up with everything looking flat. Why would we care about modes other than the zero mode? There wouldn't be any fluctuations. They would be ironed out. They would be diluted away. And the thing is that quantum theory never sleeps, right? So even if you have a clean slate, quantum fluctuations will produce fresh inhomogeneities. And so inflation is a theory in which pre-existing inhomogeneities are wiped out and then replaced by fresh inhomogeneities due to quantum fluctuation. And these are the ones we want to calculate now. So we have here phi of x is the bulk zero-mode big inflaton field, the one that we just calculated its evolution of, plus a little phi of x and eta. These are perturbations around that field. And for consistency, we will now have to assume that phi is small. Whatever phi does, its quantum fluctuations and whatnot, we will have to assume that its amplitude is small compared to the zero mode's amplitude. Because if it's not small, we would have to take its contribution to the energy momentum tensor into account, and that would feed back onto the evolution of the universe, and we haven't taken that into account. So if we want to get away with our analysis of the zero mode that we did so far, with the ball rolling down the hill and all of that stuff, and the effective cosmological constant, if we want to get away with this, we will have to assume that whatever the quantum field phi does, it's small. It's going to be a small effect. Something like 10 to minus 5, 10 to minus 6, that's fine. But if it's larger than that, then we may have to take it into account. This is what is called back reaction. Quantum fluctuations would back react onto our assumptions that we had before. All right, so now we allow small inhomogeneities in the metric. In the metric as well. Not only, I mean, the metric we assumed so far to be spatially isotropic and homogeneous, but, well, we have to allow this to fluctuate as well. And in fact, we will do a little bit of quantum gravity here because we will assume, we will quantize gravitational degrees as well. So we will write the metric as we treated it before. the scale factor times the Minkowski metric. I mean, just the flat metric. Remember why that was possible? It was possible because we used conformal time and co-moving coordinates. That made sure that the metric looks like the Minkowski metric up to a conformal prefactor. That's why it's called conformal, because it leaves the metric invariant up to a prefactor, which means angles are preserved. So it's conformal. So in our coordinate system, this is the original metric that we worked with, plus a small contribution that we now allow to fluctuate. This is what we will treat quantum mechanically. And again, we have to assume that this is small. Because if it's not small, it would modify our analysis of the A of eta. And it shouldn't. Okay, so now the trouble here is that gamma mu nu of x and eta is not a scalar field. So far, we've only dealt with scalar fields. What shall we do? This looks bad. Should we start over again? And instead of quantizing a scalar field, quantize now a tensor field? Because that's what it is, the metric, is a tensor field. What should we do? Well, fortunately, tensor fields can be nicely decomposed into parts which we know how to quantize. Namely, the tensor field gamma mu nu, the perturbations of the metric, can be decomposed into parts of three types. There is a part of gamma mu nu. I mean, gamma mu can be written as the sum of three terms. One of those terms is a term that can be derived from scalar functions, which is to say this part of gamma mu nu is simply the second derivative of a scalar function. Okay? That will certainly give us a tensor, a two-tensor. If you just differentiate a scalar function twice, it gives you a two-tensor, right? So, but of course, you can't necessarily get an arbitrary two-tensor this way. Not every two-tensor is simply the second derivative of a scalar function, right? So there's going to be other contributions, too. We will write gamma mu nu as a part, which can be written in this way, plus the rest. And the rest can be decomposed into one part, which can be written as a derivative of a vector field. That is going to be giving us a two-tensor, right? Plus the rest. Stuff that cannot be written as a first or second derivative of either a vector field or a scalar. And that is, so to speak, true tensor, right, with no scalar or vector parts in it. This decomposition is very similar to the decomposition in electromagnetism that you can do for, let's say, electric fields. You can decompose electric fields into gradient parts and into curl parts. The gradient part is that part of the electric field which is simply a derivative of a scalar. Okay? But then there remains another part, and that's the curl. And for tensor fields, it's just one level more. Okay, so this decomposition is convenient because the three types are independent. They obey independent equations of motion, which we can independently quantize, and on top of that, they are all Clangon equations. So, all right. So, all right, except for the vector part, but that part drops out. Just as a last remark before we close today, I have to be louder and louder to overcome the kids here. Okay, so what will happen is this, and that's what we will do next time, is we will decompose the metric field, the metric perturbation field, into these three components, stuff that can be obtained from a scalar field by twice differentiating, plus stuff that can be obtained from a vector field with once differentiating, and stuff that cannot, the rest, that cannot be obtained this way. And then we will look at their equations of motion, and then the following will turn out. The part that corresponds to, that can be obtained from vector fields, actually will not be of cosmological significance. It will just so turn out that those equations of motion don't lead to amplified quantum fluctuations. Then we are left with the two parts, the scalar part of the metric and the true tensor part, the remaining tensor part of the metric. The scalar part will be coupled through the Einstein equation to the inflaton field fluctuations. Together, they will form only 1 degree of freedom because they're coupled through the Einstein equation. If one fluctuates, the other fluctuates. It's just they are linked through the Einstein equation. So there's 2 degrees of freedom, but one equation removes one, so you're just left with one. That's called the Mukhanov degree of freedom. This is the one that we've seen. This is the one that is apparently responsible for the fluctuations in the constant microwave background. The tensor fluctuations, we hope to be able to see as well, they would manifest themselves in non-trivial fluctuations of the polarization of the light from the constant microwave background. And last year, the Planck satellite was launched, which is, among other things, trying to see that, trying to see a non-trivial curl part of the vector field that represents the polarization in the constant microwave background. But all of those things, of course, we'll get in the next hour as well, I mean, in detail. Wow, this is nerve-wracking. This kid. Okay, any questions?
How is it so inflation historic that zero growth has jumped down to zero?
Yeah, phi would have to jump down to zero.
How did it get there?
Oh, just the quantum fluctuation.
But
you see, it doesn't have
so
to be this way.
It's just virtually there until something measures it.
Oh, the whole thing is only virtual. You see, the whole expansion of the universe, the creation of the huge universe, and the flattening of it, and what the inflaton field does, what the three parts of the metric are doing, all of it, all virtual.
And theory. History becomes true. Because it gets measured.
Well, what do you mean by history becomes true?
Well,
you think of any quantum system. You prepare it, and you let it evolve, and you measure it. Now, if you do measurement, it doesn't really allow you, the measurement, to definitely conclude which way it went there. It's just like the double slit experiment. Just by measuring where the particle arrived doesn't tell you which slit it went to. And in fact, if it did, it would be contradictory.
So we're sort of, what we're doing this year, saying it started small and expanded, and you need particles, and then it gets, and that's why it's there.
Yeah.